Welcome to the Full Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording, and it is 3:09 p.m. and that is Central Time. Today is February 27th. Thought we'd kick off with the Dow Jones. It paired its advance earlier on today, and then pretty much finished where it started the day. But I think what's more important is that it's pretty much exactly where it was a year ago. So even though we've had a lot of back and forth, where the amplitude of the range has been from about 29,000 up to about 35,000, and we're currently around 32 and a bit, that the bigger point here is that there's been a significant loss of momentum, that we went through a very prolonged period of outperformance of US equities. And over the course of the last year, they really haven't gone much of anywhere. And they're certainly down from the peaks that were set right at the beginning of 2022. Now, of course, this wouldn't be the first time we've had a medium-term range. So we do have to then put into some perspective whether this is a range within an ongoing secular bull market, or whether this is a topping formation. And obviously, this type of consideration pops up every time there is a medium-term correction in an ongoing bull market. And this is most especially true for the Nasdaq, because it has also gone through a very significant period of underperformance. It's pulled all the way back to the region of the 1,000-day moving average, dipped below it for the first time in more than a decade, and subsequently rebounded to break the sequence of lower rally highs. So, if one were to abide by the outlook and the way of dealing with markets that has been present since 2009, which was very much in tune with the secular bull market hypothesis, then one would be buying in the region of the 1,000-day moving average. But it is worth considering that in each of the occasions when it came back to test the region of that 1,000-day moving average, all the way up from the lows in 2008 and 2009 to now, there hadn't been inverted yield curves. And on this occasion, we do. The yield curve spread is at a negative 85 basis point level. Now, it was up a little in here today, but this is far and away by the most inverted the yield curve has been. This is the 10-year minus the 2-year since the early 1980s. And it doesn't really matter how wide of a spread one is willing to look at. This is the difference between the 30-year and the 3-month, and it's at about a negative 80 basis point level, and it has tightened up a bit over the course of the last 2 weeks, because quite recently it was at negative 1% or 100 basis points. But this also graphically helps to illustrate that we had very easy monetary conditions in 2009, where there had been a massive shock as a result of the credit crisis. And we'd had central banks cutting interest rates to the lowest in a very long period of time. And then we went through successive rounds of additional monetary accommodation. And every time it looked like the economy was about to wobble, then central banks stepped in and made plenty of money available at a cheap price. And that forestalled the risk of future recessions. And one of the points that David had made on quite a few occasions was that it was unlikely that there was going to be another credit crisis so soon after the last. And that was certainly true in 2009, 10, 11, 12, when people were really fearful that the other shoe was going to drop, and that there were going to be more skeletons come out of the closet, and that there was going to be a lot of risk of a much deeper correction overall. And then that was the risk, or that was the dog that refused to bite. And subsequently, markets went up a lot. Well, now we have inverted yield curves. We have central banks that are really truly worried about inflation, and inflationary pressures are still biting. Now, what is certainly the Federal Reserve are talking tough. But the difference between the Federal Reserve and, for example, the Bank of England or the Reserve Bank of Australia is that they're also acting tough. So the Fed funds rate has been rising, and they're continuing to curtail monetary accommodation. So we've seen this huge rise in interest rates, where they've gone from about a quarter of a percent to 4.75%, and are likely to move up to 5, if not 5.25%, at the next meeting. And one of the reasons why stock markets remain reasonably steady is basically that investors are willing to bet that the peak of the interest rate cycle, regardless of whether it's at the present value at 5% or 5.5%, is going to happen in the first, maybe third of the year. And then subsequently, interest rates will start to come back down. So even though there is the potential that interest rates will continue to rise, the bet is that they're not going to continue to rise for very long. So when we then look at the 10-year yield, well, it was in negative territory in here today, and it hasn't really pushed up through the 4% level. Now, we're definitely seeing some willingness to price in additional interest rate hikes in the 2-year because it's at a new high. So that would suggest that we're not quite yet at the peak of the interest rate hiking cycle, but perhaps we're not all that far away from it either. Now, when we just zoom in again and look at that NASDAQ index, well, it did rebound in pretty emphatic fashion early today. And I suspect that some of that has to do with the Seagen acquisition by Pfizer. So they want to acquire some access to immuno-oncology or cancer treatments and view that as, and of course, because cancer treatments are so expensive, it tends to be one of the real primary money spinners for the healthcare sector. So Pfizer also is probably in need of a new growth trajectory because the share is trending downwards and has now pushed down to a new reaction low. So still unwinding the surge of activity that we saw in 2021. And this, I think, is one of the challenges that we're getting idiosyncratic events, where one big name share does well on the day, then that stirs enthusiasm among investors for part of the day. But when that news filters down and there's not much more to support it, well, then we start to see the prices starting to come back down. Now, when we look at some of these companies where they really do benefit from low interest rates, well, the ARK Innovation ETF is back below its 200-day moving average. It has not been able to sustain the move up and through it. But then let's just think about some of the darlings of the pandemic. And I haven't been a fan of Zoom for quite a long time. And the share is still really under pressure. And RingCentral is also under pressure. And something that I find really annoying is I've been in a couple of meetings recently where somebody sends a link with RingCentral. You click on it in your email, and then it doesn't open. And even though I've downloaded Ring's app onto my laptop, then you click on a link and it refuses to open, and then you've got to copy and paste it into their browser. And it's just an enormous palaver when it couldn't possibly be that difficult to have a link open inside their on desktop app, but they can't seem to get it working. And the share is certainly still trending downwards. And the incredible enthusiasm that we saw for video calling during 2020 is, I think, being absorbed into the public psyche. I will say that Microsoft Teams, even though Microsoft isn't really pioneering the video call architecture, it does work better than most. And the share, though, is back below the 200-day moving average. So we're in this point of indecision because, on the one hand, the investment community have been conditioned to buy the dip. We've had a dip and we've had some good-sized rallies. So then people are willing to step in and accumulate again. And not least because we're in the region of both the 1,000-day and the 200-day moving average. But because we still have tight monetary conditions, then the bigger question is, how are we going to see a liquidity fueled rally? Because it has been liquidity that has been fueling rallies over the last decade. If central banks are still really worried about inflation. And there is evidence of inflationary pressures that are still out there, and they're idiosyncratic in nature. So the home builders, for example, are doing well because most people don't want to sell their home when they've locked in an attractive mortgage rate. If someone had been able to secure a 2.8 or 3% mortgage, then why on earth would somebody sell their home unless they had to and volunteer to then pay almost 7%? And I was just looking at what that would mean over the weekend. That I know that I was able to secure a mortgage for 3%. And if I were to buy the same house today, even at the same price, well, then I would be offered a rate of 6.9%. So that's a hefty jump in the interest rate. And then it would also represent a really significant jump in the monthly costs. So people are, though, buying new builds, and those are the only available inventory right now. And that is beneficial for the housing building sector. Then I saw this news story today from Cleveland Cliffs. You have the CEO coming out and saying that they're raising prices and not really giving any rationale for it, but simply saying because we can. And they're one of the primary providers of steel to the automotive sector. They're basically saying that demand from the automotive sector is recovering, that they have the ability to raise prices, so that's what they're doing. At least that's helping the share to bounce here from the region of the 200-day moving average. And then let's think about Nucor. So more of a focus on other kinds of steel. And the share has outperformed in a really quite robust fashion. So then, of course, it does beg the question, if Cleveland Cliffs is raising prices because automotive companies are buying more steel, then shouldn't these automotive companies also be passing on some of those rising costs? So obviously, that is going to be problematic. Either they're going to have to sell more vehicles or raise the price even further for the ones that they are selling. And I think they've probably exhausted that particular avenue because that's what they did during the pandemic. They made fewer cars and charged more for them. In many respects, the slowdown in economic activity that we're seeing right now is being led by the white-collar sector. And that's actually not typical. Usually, manufacturing is much more sensitive to liquidity. And it's usually that factory workers, they are generally paid better than other blue-collar workers because of the volatility of their employment conditions. But what we're seeing more of is that white collar workers are being let go. So lots of tech workers or management consultants have been let go. And this is a rather interesting phenomenon because there's a multiplier effect. When someone who is making $200,000 or $300,000 or $400,000 is suddenly let go and finds themselves unable to pay for all the creature comforts that they were accustomed to, it has a significant knock-on effect. Has a knock-on effect on supermarkets, on pet grooming, and on other kinds of grooming too, for that matter. And then obviously that will filter down into the blue collar sector. So just because we're seeing the white collar sector being most acutely affected in the short term, it does not mean that the blue collar sector will be completely immune. Now, in Australia today, the ASX 200 was down in a fairly dynamic manner, and it's coming back into the region of the 200-day moving average. The RBA has come out and is a little bit more panicky about trying to talk down inflation. They are pretty inhibited in what they can do because there is it's a little bit more than a quarter of all mortgages are going to refix this year, and that could double their interest rate. So that's going to have a knock-on effect on economic growth because it will hamper demand. And then there's the question of what happens with property prices, because the property market has been one of the most buoyant globally for the last decade. Now, with interest rates rising, it's having a deleterious effect. But then there's also the question about what happens in China. I think the most important thing that's happening is that Xi Jinping is looking to harness even greater control in his hands by basically taking over the central bank. And that's really not great news for governance. And the H-share index continues to unwind the end of the COVID zero policy rebound. So this, I think, is going to be a rather difficult environment for Chinese shares. That there was a lot of enthusiasm to think that China would have the same kind of jump in demand growth that the rest of the world had. And so far, at least, it hasn't really manifested. And of course, that's going to be most particularly evident in how well do the luxury goods companies continue to perform. So LVMH popped on the upside and pulled back in a fairly dynamic manner last week, then steadied a bit in here today, but it's really quite overbought. And then Hermes, having had a very clear reversion to the 1,000-day moving average, rebounded emphatically in the second half of last year, and now it is steadying here in the region of its all-time peak. So this is a big question here. If we're having a white collar recession, then that should impact demand for very expensive luxury goods. And then, of course, if China's economic revival disappoints, that would also hamper demand. But so far, there's not a lot of evidence to support either of those claims from the performance of the luxury goods. So I think they will be particularly relevant to monitor, because if they do roll over, well, then that is going to be evidence of a less willing global population to buy or to go out and spend. And then let's think about what's going on in Europe, because the German 2-year hit another new high in here today. So now it is trading above the 3% level, and the ECB is expected to continue to raise rates. So there's no sign of this selling pressure ebbing just yet. Now, I think that it is likely we're going to have a deflationary shock. But obviously that's not a majority opinion. And a subscriber sent me an article by Saxo over the weekend. I'll post it tomorrow. But I think the big question here is when you have a monetary policy that's tightening, when the size of central bank balance sheets are contracting, and not just one country but in several, when interest rates are rising aggressively, when money supply growth is negative, then it might have a lagged effect. But ultimately, when you suck that volume of cash out of the global system, it will have a knock-on effect for inflation, and it could quite easily deliver deflation. And I think that's something that will also be evident in gold. And the price has come back to test the $1,800 area. So it's just about unwound its overbought condition relative to the 200-day moving average. And the pace of the decline is starting to ebb a little. But it's going to need an upward dynamic to really confirm that we're back in a demand-dominated environment. And if we can do that, well, I think then the chances are that it will take out those peaks in excess of $2,000 in pretty short order. But we do need that upward dynamic to signal that some demand growth is coming back in here. And then platinum, having pulled back really violently on Friday, rebounded pretty emphatically in here today. And copper, having been quite weak at the end of last week, was also a little steadier in here today. So firming from the upper side of the underlying range in the region of the 200-day moving average. So this is still an uptrend despite the uptick in volatility. And I think there's a lot of discussion about renewable energy and how much is required for the zero emission utopian ideal of the renewable energy sector. I think it's impossible to get to a zero carbon emissions environment without nuclear. And nuclear stocks were rebounding in here today. But even then, there's going to have to be a phenomenal increase in the quantity of mined materials. And there's not a lot of appetite for building new mines. And we continue to see these heartstring pulling type of media coverage that is really an indictment of how damaging it is to live in close proximity to a mine. So obviously these are very difficult issues, and when you simply can't produce the volume of material required to build what you want, well then either the cost of building it is going to go up significantly, which is obviously going to impact the economics, or you have to find an alternative. Now, there's lots of technological innovation going on, and solar cells are getting more efficient, and they keep building the wind turbines taller so that they've got an even bigger swing, and therefore they come out just on a cost per megawatt basis cheaper the bigger you go. And then there are clear innovations happening in the battery sector. But then we have to start thinking about just providing electricity, and the transmission cables alone would represent a huge bull market in copper. Just simply to connect all of that distributed energy to the grid would require just a massive demand curve for copper, and that's before we consider all of the copper that goes into all of those motors and wires and electric vehicles. So these are obvious considerations that are supporting the price. But then, on the other hand, you have the negatives, which is that global growth is slowing down. And that what we are seeing right now is the inflationary boom part of the cycle. Because people start accelerating purchases. So instead of waiting, people are worried about the value of the money in their pockets or the money in their bank accounts. They feel like they have to spend, so then they go out and they accelerate their purchases. And ultimately, then in order for that process to continue, wages have to continue to rise. And if we're in an environment where interest rates are rising and companies have a more difficult time, well, then that's going to put a damper on those wages. And then savings take a hit, and then you get a recession. And I suspect that's where what we're going to have, that we're having an inflationary boom right now, and then we're going to have potentially it's either going to be an inflationary bust or a deflationary bust. My money is on the potential for a deflationary bust because of those monetary conditions. And I think with that, I will leave you for today, and I'll wish all the best to all of you.